This is The Good Die Young, the podcast where we deep dive into the greatest television you barely saw. I'm your host, Les Weiler. Join me as I take you through what made these shows too pretty to live. This is The Good Die Young. Season 1, The Middleman. Hey, this is Les. Welcome to The Good Die Young. I am here with Melissa Irwin.
Hello.
I know you thought we were done last episode because, and I could see where you would get this from, there were only 12 episodes of the TV show we're covering. So it seems crazy to have a 13th episode. Well, let me tell you a little something about The Middleman. There were comic books before there were TV shows. In fact, The Middleman comic book, or The Middleman TV show rather, sprung from Javier Grillo Marxwatch literally writing the pilot that he could not film. He wrote an unfilmable TV pilot. And so that TV pilot became a comic book because there's no budget constraints. And then after a while, it magically did become a TV show. But we're going to talk about the comic book universe because there's some differences and it builds towards a confrontation with the also canonical corporate universe. Now, you have a background in comics.
I do, actually. I had self-published some of my own stuff back in the mid-2000s through 2011, and I've done some freelance work here and there on, you know, various projects throughout the years, but it was never really my main gig.
What got you into comics?
I got into them probably when I was around 10 or 11, and I became a diehard X fan for a long time, and then I got lost interest in high school because, you know, social acceptance, and then I got back into it in college because I didn't care about that stuff anymore.
And how did you first come across The Middleman?
Honestly, you introduced me to the show.
That's everybody's answer. I've done this to all my co-hosts. For your episode here, I had you read, it's a little bit different than everybody else co-hosting. You didn't have an episode to watch. You had a graphic novel that I handed you.
The entire series, plus some addendums like pinups near the back, alternate cover versions, stuff that you're supposed to pack into a trade paperback to justify why somebody wants to rebuy it if they already have all the issues.
The Trade Paperback Initiative. That's what it was called.
Yeah.
This one that I have, my copy from Amazon that I loaned to Melissa, actually has, ironically, the ABC Family advertisement cover.
Yeah, which really throws off from the interior.
And I guess we should, it's a good place to open in discussing why that is so jarring. Wendy Watson, as she appears in the ABC Family TV show, no character resembling her appears in this comic.
No, it's a totally different look entirely. I mean, the ethnicity of Wendy for me didn't come across in the book as far as like looking at her being anything particular. I guess she's supposed to be a redhead. I don't really necessarily get that off of the drawings.
Yeah, it's a black and white comic, though.
Yeah, so that part, I'm like, but then, again, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of, one of the things that I'm disappointed about is I really just don't like the TV costume as much as I do the book costume.
The midriff shirt and
yeah,
the
exactly.
Kind of gunslinger
it just seems,
belt.
I don't know, like my like former goth nerd girl self really appreciates that look more though than like the standard secret agent in a leather outfit that you know smells bad when you peel it off. I've had a pair of vinyl pants. I wore them like 5 times, and then like the last time I was just like, that's nasty. You can't do that. I don't. All those guys that you see on stage, rock stars that wear those things, their balls smell nasty.
See, Middleverse problems. I'm sure O2STK has some kind of wicked cool gadget that hopefully
takes
care of that.
Yeah, maybe it's like wicking pleather or something.
The comic book universe has not just a few ethnicity differences. I'm Wendy being a redhead in a midriff shirt, but Noser in the comic books is a dreadlocked white guy with a soul patch kind of goatee thing going on.
I think that was probably something that's dated from like early to mid 2000s because we all had that guy hanging out and around. Like, so it made sense in that context. But I'm thinking if you were to just pick this up now, that kind of character would make no sense. Like to you and me in our age group, oh yeah, we've all had like that was our dorm roommate or one of our roommates first out of college or the guy that lived in our apartment building, literally like in this. Whereas I don't know if a younger generation would recognize that trope.
I think between then and now, Ja Trent happened. Or whatever the Lonely Island guys,
yeah.
Andy Sandberg did the send-up song, and that's now what I think of as that. But prior to that, yeah, that's just the dude that played Ultimate that lived down the hall from me and smelled bad.
Exactly.
Like, I knew that guy in college.
I had all of these guys hanging around, so...
So in the comic, Nozer, I think, becomes a botanist.
Yeah, randomly, kind of towards the end, it's just like this guy does nothing but quote song lyrics, and then suddenly, like, wait, you've been working on this behind the scenes? I mean, I'm assuming you had a different life. I had no idea it was rich and varied.
I just love
how
that
it plays into anything.
I love that even separate from the show, like even more so than the show, the comic book continues on this... this pattern of just dropping in insane things Nozer is not just competent at, but like top of his field.
Yeah.
Top of someone else's field. Top of all the fields. He's the top.
Which is, again, the thing that makes that kind of depiction of that character funny. Like, this whole time, you mean my friend Hootie was, who actually is a very good songwriter. That guy was also on top of like physics. Okay.
Yeah.
You
and,
know?
And, yeah. He's obviously a world-class ventriloquist. Well, that we know in our universe.
Yeah.
So I had the hardest time watching this show not conflating the two universes. Like, I so want some of the few things that happen in the comics differently. My brain just kind of wraps it all in the same universe. And it's very important to keep these distinct. Because plot-wise, there actually comes a, I guess, 14th, 15th episode that they did for the table reads where the comic book canonical universe... and the TV universe actually meet, and all these characters end up sharing scenes together. So, like, both Wendy's are together, and
yeah, you can't discount the one being different than the other one because they've done a thing where they've combined them to be like, oh no, these are both valid, and
yeah.
So you can't write off and be like, well, that's not the real way Wendy would do that because, well, there is two Wendy's,
yep.
And then they kind of do solve that in the back of at least the trade. I don't know if how that fit into with the regular. Issue releases, but when they offer up some little vignette stories at the end of other versions of Middleman throughout the years, and you see that there's other versions of Wendy throughout the years too, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. The comic book is drawn by Les McLean, who partnered with Javi to do the comic. Javier Grillo-Marx watched, he was working on Charmed, I believe, and one of the things that he had to do writing on Charmed was explain everything. If you had a vampire episode on Charmed, you had to assume that the Charmed audience had never seen vampires, and you would have to have someone explain vampires. Like, oh my God, they have two dots in their neck. No one in the room knows what that means. You have to have someone info dump what that means. And he got so sick of like doing a genre show, maybe not sick of it, but it was irritating to do a genre show that couldn't assume your audience had seen any genre. And so he wrote Middleman as just... the opposite of that. Let's assume everyone knows everything.
And mishmash all of it together to where... that was one of the things I was thinking about in particular, where you start out with like a later issue where it's basically starts as a Bond parody, but by the end becomes like an anime mech parody. And the moment that happens, I had to go back and flip through a few pages and be, okay, we have mutant sharks, Bond Island, bikini, and now there's robot mech suits.
And in the comic, he's got a straight up Bond villain. Like, there's a Spectre organization,
which kind of gets thrown in, and then I'm still not really fully sure how does that fit in compared with all the other acronyms, which I do think is part of the running gag. Like, you're supposed to have trouble keeping these.
Oh, there's an insane amount of acronyms in the comic book. Later, they end up in the Spoilsport room, which. I mean, then they've got the bummer, which is the bomb that they set off in one of the TV episodes,
yeah.
That bums out the whole room. Yeah, their acronyms are spectacular. But Fatboy, which Fatboy Industries is all over the TV show. Every single product in the TV show is Fatboy. They run everything. And they even are in the parallel universe. They run the dystopia. And in the comic book, though, they are not a friendly company called Fatboy. It is an acronym. And it stands for Federated Agents of Tyranny, Betrayal, and Oppression's Yoke.
Yeah, mouthful. I think Fatboy works better for them.
Yes.
And I give them props for straight up just putting oppression in there.
Yeah.
Hey, we're not going to mince words about that. Yeah, we're oppressing.
And betrayal's in there too. I mean, yeah,
like you should have seen that coming.
You got to appreciate an organization that has betrayal right there in their
yeah,
title.
We're
like,
not even going to pretend.
All members of this, you know what you're getting. I do love that. In the comic book, Les McLean drew Manservant Neville to look like Mark Shepard.
Without it knowing.
And then
how
they
that
cast
was...
Mark Shepard. So Javi wrote the show, or rather wrote the comic book kind of as a reaction to Charmed. Like, I just want to write a genre thing where everybody's read all of this shit. And so he wrote an unfilmable pilot. There's no way to get the budget to do all this, right? If you throw everything in there. And you and I both know that's basically why comic books
happen
exist.
A lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, you don't have the budget? You just have storyboards? Okay, you have a comic book.
And it requires people, you have to use a little bit of your own imagination. Even if it's literally being drawn out for you, you still have to convey that in a way that people can readily see in their own mind, like, what is this? I mean, in this case, yeah, it's black and white. So what are these colors? And then how does this all fit together? Because it's just squiggly lines. The fact that we're able to recognize it as forms that we identify as people, and then what those people are doing, which it's harder to make happen in comic book form than people really understand.
You and I were talking about this the other day. I forget the, like, Scott McCloud understanding comics lesson of, like, this is the sun going up and then going down. Like, people, that there are people who look at that and don't see sequential time.
Don't understand, like, the order to read word balloons in. And I mean, in some cases, yeah, if there's a lot of word balloons and if they're poorly arranged, it can be hard to follow along. But that's something that people who don't read comics that will attempt to read them for the first time will note. I don't remember what order I'm supposed to do this in.
If there's a wonderful video online about Art Spiegelman's Mouse, about the years that he took to lay out those pages. And it goes through and highlights, like, the various elements in the composition, because almost every page of that does two or three things where, like, if you were to kind of squint your eyes and focus on a different element, you would see, like, a different structured, solid layout. And it had to have been maddening to design not just the visual page, but the story to flow like that. And yeah. I think people forget how much is involved.
I definitely think about that with, you know, I'm getting ready to draw, to pencil and ink a self-published book for someone else. And I have to revisit how I did that when I laid my own things out. Because, yeah, as you're drawing, you have to kind of account for how are the word balloons going to fit into this and make sure that they flow in such a way that it carries people's vision through the panels so that the panels are in order and you're not suddenly looking back and thinking, wait, what am I missing here? And having to put together pieces, which helps if you have very few words and very minimal balloons. But sometimes comics can get significantly wordier. Like if you're reading something from Warren Ellis, half your page is
or
talking.
Scripts from Alan Moore are insane.
Yeah. I mean, at least David Mack will do things like write some of his dialogue and stuff in there. And then you're supposed to be taking it out of order a little bit, or he's leaving it up to you to decide how to read it and interpret it yourself versus if you really need to have, because I know if I'm looking at a page and there's lettering or words, my eyes track to that before it does to the action. I have to read what's there and then look at what's happening.
Yeah, I do the same. I can't not read things. If you put English up in front of me, I'm going to read it immediately, street signs, whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, when I see words on a page, that's the first thing I have to make myself then take in the page.
Yeah, unless somehow you like can do things like obscure the words partially behind.
Yeah, I think about the amount of times that like Dave McKean or somebody has like dreamy text flow into the background and stuff. And you know that that's kind of extra info that will fill out the scene, but you don't need to read it first necessarily.
Exactly.
So when Javi decided that he had the unfilmable pilot, let's make this into a comic book, he shopped around and there was a guy drawing a comic, Les McLean. A comic was called, I think, Highway 13. Had them driving, it was a buddy cop thing with a guy and his werewolf partner. I think his werewolf partner was named Garth. And they
kind of vaguely remember this a little bit.
They drove a Haruk Grey Wolf, which is another model from the Haruk car line that gave us the Bugbear in The Middleman. Wendy drives a Haruk Bugbear. And so there's a lot of stuff from Highway 13 that kind of came over to The Middleman universe. This sense of men in blackness that everything's true. Highway 13 was kind of a supernatural, everything's true kind of book.
And that helps fill out that reference to me because I caught that. I actually knew when they're comparing her car to a Yugo. And I was like, I actually knew somebody and it didn't have one, but three Hugos.
Oh, man.
One was red, one was blue, and one was white. And they really wanted to put them in the town parade. But I was like, yeah, I know Yugo. I've ridden in the back of one of those. Not a comfortable experience.
You can still find the photos online. I think it was School of Visual Arts in New York, maybe. Or it might have been City University, but there was a college in New York that gave their graduate student art department Yugos as their graduate project.
And
so each person got a Yugo. And so like there's one that's completely made into a Zippo lighter where they cut it and like the half third of the car is open with the flame, and somebody made a confessional booth. Somebody made a giant phone with a receiver over the top of it. Like, they're amazing. You can still find the photos of all those online. So Highway 13 brought a lot of the look and feel. Javi already loved that comic and contacted Les and brought him on. And then they shopped it around to different comic companies, and Viper bit. Viper out of Dallas, Texas. I think at the time, I'm not sure if they had done Dead at 17 yet, but Josh Howard was kind of their first big hit guy that I ever saw. And this would have been, early 2000s.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm really familiar with much of their line at all.
Being out of Dallas, they were all over the place here in Austin. And so I knew a few people that were involved with them, either writing stuff. Jason Burns wrote stuff for them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think anytime I did see them back then, it would be at coming to things like cons down here in Texas is, I think, where I mostly remember seeing them.
Yeah, if you made it down here for a Staple or for a Wizard World, they were there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They shopped it around and Viper picked it up and started putting it out. And I at the time that it was coming out, I really wasn't looking for a black and white comic. It just really wasn't what I wanted to read. I don't really think I was that heavy into comics right at that moment. And so I didn't really look at it. I have a few issues of it, but I didn't read it all. Then the show came out and I fell in love with it. And then after the show finished, they did some more comics, but it threw me off because they didn't get Les back.
Yeah.
At that point, he was already busy working on, I think, Major Lazer. He was doing some character design and poses and stuff for a couple of animated shows. You just bad timing, just too busy.
Yeah, definitely. And so that seems like they work it out well to where it at least comes back in as being these extra kind of added on stories so that it's, yeah. You know, you can look and be like, oh, okay, this is different now. And plus, they're drastically different styles.
Yeah, and so they did a couple of things. They got some other guys from Viper and some other artists to do. I think Josh Howard from Dead at 17 has an extra story in the back. So in the book you read, it's almost entirely Les and then two or three other artists that did little, like, kind of one-shots in the back.
Yeah.
Whatever, Tales from the Middle Verse kind of stuff. And then, ironically, when they went to do the next comic, it was going to be a comic book wrap-up for the show, the TV verse, where Fat Boy's a company that makes coffee cups and shit and isn't the Federated Agents of Tyranny, Betrayal, and Oppression's yoke. So by getting Zanker and changing art style slightly, I knew some people that were really irritated, that loved the cartooniness of McLean's work, but didn't like Zanker's slightly different style. There's a little more angular style to Zanker's work in this. And for me, I thought it was brilliant because Zanker ends up getting to draw just the TV universe in comic form. And it gives it this wholly separate look than the comic universe.
Yeah, which they kind of carry on when they do these extra stories for to fill in back of being the middleman throughout the past. Each one is done in a different style, still somewhat cartoony, but obvious. So that to me makes, oh, okay, this is a different parallel universe. So everything is drawn this way, which I kind of like that idea.
So plot wise in the comics, the first 8 issues or so of the comics are about 2 episodes of the TV show. Something Les McLean mentioned in his interview was how fun it was to watch the show because they got to go so fast through so much material that would take, you know, a series of issues to arc through. That would be like one 40-minute episode.
Yeah.
And so very quickly the show got ahead of where he got to go. And so he got new material, you know, like, oh, I got to see new show almost immediately. Because the first few issues of the comic, flat cover, the Gorilla Mobsters, the Luchador and Sensei Ping and the Cage of Light.
Yeah.
Then it kind of starts to break down and you start to get elements from other episodes, but maybe not the whole episode itself into one. It's not exactly one-to-one comic. I do feel like the first issue of the comic, it is just the script. I mean, it all the dialogue, with the exception of the comic references, and I think the Johnny Cash reference they listen to in the song, is exactly the TV script.
I'm glad that got dropped, though, at some point. I as soon as that came up in the comic, I'm like, I don't know if I would really be into this as a thing. You know. And here's the thing. I like Johnny Cash, and I like country music, but I don't know. That seemed like we're going to throw in this weird personality quirk, and I kind of like that it lasted for a little bit, and then it just got dropped as unnecessary.
Yeah. I also like the song Palomino that they use in the TV show because they pull it from Tree Adams, the show composer, actually wrote it. And I liked having an original song for him. Like, sure, he likes country, but only this.
Yeah. This, like, specific one.
Yeah, this one weird song no one's heard. That made me happier than obligatory Johnny Cash reference.
Yeah, especially if it's, we're talking Johnny Cash songs that we've all been to those rockabilly shows where we've heard everybody play it over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I'd like a deeper cut if we're going to go Cash. So, plot-wise, the comic really treads through a lot of the same stuff as the TV universe, albeit with a couple of canonically different characters. But so it always kind of struck me as odd that they're different but the same. On the one hand, you have these plots that I've seen as the TV show, and I have to continually remind myself that what I'm reading there is not the same universe, that these things happened very similarly but not quite the same, because somebody that is completely missing from the TV universe is the actual main villain. Manservant Neville is a henchman in the comic book. All he does, I mean, he is the top dog in the TV universe. Manservant Neville is evil. In the comic book universe, he is a gorilla suit wearing, machine gun toting henchman to the real bad guy, Kahneman Kang.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why Kahneman Kang is not in the show. I kind of wish they'd introduced him and just run with it.
Maybe that was something they were waiting to do later on down the road, as far as, you know, if there, at some point they were like, we'll have to resolve this stuff with Manservant Devil. So then we find, oh, he was working for this guy
exactly.
all along.
I was kind of always hoping that they would, you know, suddenly reveal that, like, oh, what if the great and powerful Oz was actually a stooge, you know?
Exactly.
And this is your real villain. Plus, there's something about Kahneman Kang that just sounds like a Buckaroo Banzai, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle villain. It just sounds insane. I'm sure it's an homage or nod to something that I'm missing. But Kahneman,
well, it just sounds so much like all the you know, a random Bond villain or a random
Ming the Merciless.
Or, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, you put those syllables together of like the K and.
Yeah.
And then it just ends up sounding kind of fairly, you know, David Lopan-ish.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I do like in the Tales of the Middleman, you get a couple of nods that Wendy's always kind of been a badass and has always barely put up with this shit. That even though some middlemen in the past have been more like guy from the 60s and less Boy Scoutish, I think there's one in there where they intimate that middleman kind of keeps trying to use Wendy's feminine wiles to get him through stuff.
Yeah, it's a definite takeoff on the Conan universe where they're trying to portray him as this barbarian type working through this medieval sort of backwoods scenario. And then Wendy's job in this is ultimately implies that her job is to distract enemy soldiers more than once by flashing them or performing sex acts with them. And then at some point it comes revolves where she's like, you don't really think I was actually doing that whole time. Like, she was beating them up off panel, but
yeah,
he had apparently assumed and been okay with the idea that she was sleeping with people to get them out of his way.
Yeah, I was a little bit torn on, like, on the one hand, I like that they turned it back around with her going, I'm sorry, you thought I was doing what? No, I was kicking the shit out of them.
I was luring them off into the bushes and beating them up.
Yeah, I've beaten every villain we've ever fought. You thought I slept with all of them? Because, yeah, I like the twist on the end, but, yeah, I spent most of reading that going, man, this is not all right. This is really not okay.
Yeah, it was just like going like, so this doesn't fit along with any of the other things we've seen about Wendy at this point. Like, I don't even think Lacey would sink to this low.
Yeah, yeah, I'm pretty sure, well, I think if she had anybody in her sublet right now, they'd have called her out on this temp job in particular. Like,
yeah,
this is worse than booty chest.
No, no.
But I did like the reveal that she's just flat kicking the shit out of them.
Yeah, it was all just a ruse to get them to disappear over here off panel and then whack them over the head.
It does bring up something that came up during the cryogenic episode for me, which was, what criteria exactly does O2STK choose middlemen? Because this kind of seems like giving Guy Gardner a Green Lantern ring. Like, did you think this through at all? How did Conan end up as a middleman?
Yeah, why did you go with that in this particular universe? Was it just, are you picking somebody based off of their physical skills? I mean, the reason, and basically the way I understand it is, a sidekick is initially supposed to be the apprentice for the new position, or they outright say they pick Wendy because she has a blasé ability to roll through weird circumstances and not bat an eye. Like, this is a normal, or if something is clearly abnormal, it doesn't seem to shake her.
I can see where, though, if you're just picking on unflappability, that could just get you a psychopath.
Yeah, exactly. Which kind of seems like maybe that's what they wound up with in that particular version, since he was, totally willing to use his female sidekick's body.
Yeah, and I have to wonder if this is kind of like the Green Lanterns ending up with a Sinestro occasionally, that, you know, if you just have a ring pick iron willpower, sometimes you're going to get willpower that leads a terrible direction.
Yeah, it's going to go awry. That could have been a potential future idea, is to find the middleman universe where middleman became one of the bad guys.
Yeah.
The villain in that particular universe.
Yeah, where you've got like the good Lex kind of crisis of two Earths. Was there anything in particular in the comic that jumped out at you? Any particular gags or story that you really...
Oh, the first one that really got me giggling was in the... I think it's the very first panel of Enter the Dragon Conundrum, and it says J.R. Bob Dobbs Airport.
Yes.
And I was like, yeah, nice.
I'm so glad they kept that location on the TV show as well.
Excellent.
Once again, Church of the Subgenius is another Dallas-based organization. And yeah, if you don't know who Bob Dobbs is, it's okay. You're still included in the sale.
Yeah.
I love those guys. I got in trouble in high school with a couple of friends putting out a newsletter, an underground zine that just made fun of the faculty in our high school with nothing but Subgenius references. It was pretty much half Subgenius references and half making fun of the orthopedic shoes of our teachers and shit. It was really juvenile. And yeah, it was ridiculous. Like, we would pass them out in secret, just leave them around the school and shrug, like, I don't know where those came from. And yeah, I ended up in the principal's office.
Yeah, I'll definitely say, as far as reading through the comic, the overall plot to me seemed like it mostly just existed as a way of moving things along so they could get from gag to gag and drop in all these references as a way of saying, like, I'm assuming that you're going to have some frame of reference for some of this. Like, I want to think like a Gremlins reference at one point, talking about, you know, Master Ping, and she's the first thing. He's like, okay, I get it. No feeding him after midnight, or absolutely no, don't ever get him wet. And then when they're talking about they're trying to track the luchadors, and then suddenly he just starts like naming off all these organic ingredients from this like evidence sample that they find, and it's the recipe for mole sauce.
Yeah.
That was the kind of stuff that like definitely seemed to me like comical and intriguing, to the point where I was like, wait, you're actually, I think you're supposed to be following a story here. You need to really pay attention to what's going on.
And weirdly, almost all of those things, I mean, the show is just as densely packed with references, but there's somehow the main plot, and maybe it's just the difference in reading versus watching live action, but in the TV show, I very much don't feel like it is... cramming references down my throat. I feel like there's a plot that happens to have a shitload of incidental references in it. Whereas in the comic book, I feel the references are more forward somehow. Like I feel like I know what you mean. Like I feel like I'm going from reference text to reference text.
Yeah, without paying attention to what's actually happening to her. There'd be a few times where I'd go through a few pages and suddenly we'd wind up in a different scene or a different scenario, and I'd have to go back and say, oh yeah, these aren't just a series of skits. There's a thing happening here, and I need to, and it's not even like it's that hard of a, it's not that there's a plot's hard to follow at all. It's not too overly complicated. They do a pretty good job of being linear and things happening, but yeah, as you're reading the references, they come at such a pace that I'm looking more at that and less so much as what's happening. And then suddenly like, oh, wait, we're on this island, or we're on this ship right now.
I wonder if that stems from all of the dialogue, like all of the text having equal weight. Quite literally, it's...
throughout the entire thing.
That when I'm reading the comic, something that would be an under-the-breath throwaway line, like, oh yeah, good one, or what, like some throwaway insult line or whatever, or jab, would be an under-the-breath at the end of a scene. But when I'm reading it in a comic book, it's the same... It's the same kind of talk bubble as incredibly pertinent information I needed. Like, we've moved locations... is the same kind of text and everything as incidental joke you didn't really need.
Like a less abrasive version of your friend that always uses caps lock.
Yes.
You know, like, why are you yelling all the time?
Yeah,
like, except it's not yelling. It's just this, maybe like a Kendrick Lamar lyric.
Like just,
it's just
all
the same cadence and tone all the way through.
Yeah, because there's something about the comic book where I notice the references and I don't follow the plot quite as well. But I'm never sure if that's... if that's me reading, I feel like how tired I am and how focused I am makes a huge difference on comic books well I read them.
You know, it's one of those things is why it would bother me when people would assume that comic books were not challenging reads. They get something that, like, you don't have to be that smart to read. And it's like, oh, actually, you got to kind of, you got to pick up on how to read it, how that particular creator, writer, and artist, how are they putting this together in a way that this whole thing makes sense with words and with actions and with sequences?
Yeah.
And then with all of the same issues that you have with writing literature or screenplays is the fact that you still have to have the story make sense. You can't have these major plot holes, and you have this added element of completely inventing things visually and hope that people are able to take that somewhere with themselves.
Something that I think Nate Bliss had mentioned in one of the episodes he co-hosted, he got to co-host a couple of the episodes that are drawn from or pulled from the comics. And something that he mentioned was that the first comic book he didn't enjoy quite as much because it felt structured out and written and odd. Like, he felt like it had been moved between mediums. And I didn't so much notice that, but I can see what he means, that this is something that's been thought through for two different mediums that have two very different concerns. But yet the dialogue and everything was kept almost verbatim, and the structure of it was kept almost verbatim. That's really difficult to do. I mean,
when you do a direct adaptation of a comic book to live action and you leave it, I mean, you basically use the storyboards as the way you film your scene. Very, very often you wind up with something that looks kind of campy and over the top. And that so often ends up being the association that people have with comics based media, is thinking of it as being, you know, a little bit cheeky or something like that, because it's so literal. Well, when you're drawing a comic book, you kind of have to make a lot of things super literal, because you're making people take a drawing and see it in their head as a thing. Whereas people don't have to put forth that extra effort into a movie or a television scene.
One of the main things that goes off in the comics that really is not just different from the TV universe, but brings it around to dovetail together in the next couple of things, is Kanaman Kang and his entire plan.
Yeah, that whole ends up being really vital to establishing just, I guess, world building of what would the Middleman universe could have been, as far as explaining some things, tying all in this idea together that each middle boy or each sidekick is the apprentice, or is intended to be an apprentice, and that sometimes things go wrong. And then this character also is, in a weird way, like kind of almost a mirror, in the sense of, like, that character, the Kanaman Kang himself, is somebody who gets replaced by an apprentice at some point.
Yeah. So in the last of the original run of the comics, we basically watch the middleman in a flashback lose the middle boy.
Yeah.
They're escaping from foiling Kanaman Kang's plan, and as they fly away on jetpacks, I believe.
Basically taking off on, like, the murder of Jason Todd by Joker.
Straight up. And so, yeah, you watch him, and I totally believe the gag. Like, middleman turns around and the middle boy falls into an explosion, which in comic books means no one's ever dead.
Yeah.
And I still fell for it. I still had the moment of, like, because he screams, "No, you've been..."
Yeah.
Then you move on in the comic, and in a beautiful twist, you find out later on, sorry, spoilers, it's a decade-old comic that you should go buy. You find out a little bit later on that the middle boy has actually survived, apprenticed himself to the original Kang, and taken over.
And so now that he is Kanaman Kang, and he, under the guise of being the original Kanaman Kang, who Middleman wants to hunt down and destroy, you turn out he's trying to hunt down and destroy Middleman as revenge for leaving him behind.
Yes.
And then even explicitly explains, "No, you didn't see me die. You saw me fall into a rocket explosion. How did you not think I might come back from that?" Like,
yeah, in all of our adventures, nothing signaled to you that you might need to actually see my corpse?
Yeah, which is... Because in comics, yeah, that is totally a thing. You thought this person was gone.
I mean, it's kind of understandable. Like, you need to see Jean Grey's body, and even then.
Yeah, and even then, like, well.
Give it a year. Give it a few years.
So that definitely is a thing where he just flips that script a little bit of just like, why didn't you check? And so now I became, and then how it factors into the whole, like, you left me no choice. You left me no choice but to become this villain to you.
My favorite moment in the entirety of the comic books comes right after that, when middle boy, who has grown up to be Kanemon Kang now, makes this whole, I am evil because you left me, because you never came back. I had to apprentice myself to the villain, and that's the reason I became a villain. You left me no choice. And Middleman turns on him and shuts that shit right the fuck down.
Yeah, like, no, you always had a choice. You didn't have, there's nothing that made you take this one.
I don't care where I left you. No, yeah. You did not have to.
This guy actually literally shot you. Like, this is the guy who actually tried to kill you. Like, I didn't try to kill you. I made a mistake. This guy was literally causing you harm.
In a show, in a book that is known to me for setting up tropes and then zigging where it ought to zag, I loved that Middleman does not buy into that guilt at all. At all. He just looks back and like, bullshit, you had a choice. No.
I did think the way he lost the attachment to Middle Boy at that point, I thought that was like a little bit swift, even given the character just like, okay, so you're saying you've been tortured about this for decades, supposedly, now that he was killed on your watch, and now as soon as you find out he's the bad guy, you drop all of those feelings you had this whole time.
It does piss Middleman off in kind of a clean break fashion of like,
just like, oh, you know, that wow. That stage when you're dating somebody and they just do that, maybe that one thing where you're just like, all right, no, never mind.
Yeah, it is kind of sudden. But the way that then that finally ends, Middle Boy / Kang gets the drop on them in almost the final panel, right towards the end. Middleman in the comic universe gets hit with a dart in the side of the neck, and we see him die.
Yeah, and apparently seems really actually dead. And that was kind of the thing I thought at that point we were going to go into the trope of, okay, well, he's not, you know, you see Wendy holding him on the ground with the crowd standing around, and that's usually, you know, come to... don't you die on me,
yeah,
kind of moment. And I didn't actually expect that to be a real death until they just, you know, Ida, who seems like she would know more than anybody, is like, discusses it later on of just like, what a shame. And even then, though, the attitude about it was kind of blasé at the same time. Like, wait, this was a pretty integral. This guy was pretty integral. And now we're just like, oh, well, so anyway, we're moving on now.
Well, and Ida's real quick to say, don't think you're getting a promotion out of this, Toots. You're still apprentice.
No, like, you're not. That was like the big turnaround on that. Like, no, you don't automatically inherit his
spot.
That would
piss
me
off so much. That honestly, I think I would probably quit and go work for Fat Boy or something. Like, that would piss me off so much if I was the apprentice and the boss died and they rebossed me. Like,
I'd be putting in, with Kanemon Kang, like, hey, yes. So you guys are apparently, but you're bigger on loyalty than these guys are.
I see a clear path to promotion in the evil organization. Yeah. When Kanemon Kang died, you actually became Kanemon Kang. When my middleman died,
I just got assigned is my dad?
Who's her dad? Yes. Like, which, under mysterious circumstances, flying his DC-10, you know, he vanished, but...
Yeah.
And so I loved it as a... bringing in her dad is a great last panel. Like, what? Shit, I want more of this book.
Yeah, definitely. Because then you're like, well, this obviously means that there's an ongoing sort of story, and then there's going to be a whole new world of backstory to bring up again. Like, why did he disappear? How is she going to deal with the issues as far as, hey, dad, you've been gone for a big chunk of my life, and I assumed that you were just gone, but now you're telling me that you were voluntarily doing something else besides being my dad.
Yes. Yeah, and that's one of the things she's trying to decide, or trying to find out when they go to the Land of the Dead in one of the early episodes on the TV show, and TV Wendy is trying to find her TV dad. She's wanting to know if he's dead or not, because if he's dead, he can't have been there for her childhood, but that's not his fault.
Yeah.
If he's alive, there's an off chance that he's free somewhere and simply isn't part of her life by choice.
Yeah.
And that hurts.
Seems like there was probably going to be more that was going to have to be done with that. That seemed like that was an entryway into a much more expansive kind of... I mean, that brings up the idea, like, if her dad would have tried hitting on Lacey at some point after that. Like,
oh,
your
God,
dad that,
not.
Like, hits on your friends, and you're like, dad, don't
do
that.
Considering that Javi almost didn't let them... didn't let the show writers establish Lacey in Middleman... I'm really thinking they probably would have put the kibosh on that.
Yeah.
I would hope. Leaving the comic book universe with comic book Wendy having her dad show up, comic book Ida, who is a little bit different. There's no Interrogeoids in the comic book, and comic book Ida, I don't think has ever died, but she can appear as a hologram, which is weird. TV Ida does not appear as a hologram. But it leaves it in the comic book universe with Wendy, with a dead middleman, and her father having just shown up. And that's kind of where the comic book universe wraps up. And for all of us who were, you know, we were reading this at the time, that's where they left it. And then there was this show that was in a parallel, slightly different world. Only we didn't, or at least I didn't know at the time that I was watching the show, that Javi was going to leave them both canonical.
There was kind of like a snippet or one of the, you know, one of the alternate stories or one of the other short stories where it wasn't outright said, but it did kind of imply the possibility that of a later timeline and of this Wendy, of the comic book Wendy in the future, where she is actually going by the name Middleman, which she still does as Middleman, not Middle Woman or Middle Girl. She goes as Middleman, but she chooses to not have a sidekick.
Yes, she foregoes a guy who appears to be a perfectly capable sidekick, and yeah, she still forgoes it.
And she looks a lot more rough for wear than Clarence from the comic book does. By the time she meets this potential apprentice that she turns down, she looks like she's been kind of through some hell.
Yeah, she looks more like the Snake Plissken middleman from the parallel universe in the show.
Like she has gone straight up Sarah Connor on us or something.
Yeah, yeah. No fate but what she makes.
Yeah.
Well, that about wraps up our discussion of the comic book, which, again, you should go and check out. If you've enjoyed the show at all, you really owe it to yourself to go and find the Trade Paperback Initiative or one of the collections from the original comics of Les McLean and Javi.
Yeah, it's a fun light read. It's not hard to get through. It's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty basic story. It's very well drawn, you know. It's the artwork on it is really nice and really clean, easy to follow, and it's something that you can get through in the span of an afternoon probably.
I also think it's fun because if you're like me and you got 12 episodes of this show but you wanted more, here is a parallel world. While they are similar stories, they're not technically the exact same story, so you almost get this slightly off mirror universe. It's wonderful. It's not the mirror universe, they go to that in the show, but you get this other canonical universe of Middleman.
And it's always fun to get those little references, or I guess little Easter eggs between the two, to see like, oh, you kind of get a chuckle to yourself like, I recognize that, you know. I would think about going through like the first season or so of The Walking Dead, if you'd read the comics, and then as it started to depart more and more from that, being able to see like, I see a little inkling of this coming in, I see a little piece of that coming in.
There are two more volumes of comics that come after that trade paperback that you have, and volume 4 and volume 5. So volume 4 is the Doomsday Armageddon Apocalypse, and volume, which was the 2009 table read. And then volume 5 is the Pan-Universal Parental Reconciliation, which is the 2014 Comic-Con table read. So, and these are the ones that Armando Zanker worked on as well. People who've been listening to this show the entire time might have missed just the sheer volume of reference point outs that we've done in all the TV episodes. I didn't want to go through and feel like I was simply reading the comic aloud on the podcast, but also volumes 4 and 5 of the comics, which we've not discussed because we're going to cover them each in an episode, they each have a glossary in the back that is annotations and pop culture references. And I'm talking page by page breakdown from Javier about where each of these things came from. What does Fatboy stand for? Where did these names come from? Why is the pineal gland in everything? Well, the pineal gland is in everything because it's an homage to Stuart Gordon's 1986 film adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond, starring Jeffrey Combs and the ever so crush-worthy Barbara Crampton. These are the kinds of things that are word for word in the back of volumes 4 and 5. So if you've enjoyed me nerding out on the little references in this show, the reason that I didn't go through each of them on the comic book is because, more so than any of the shows and pausing them and making your own notes, you can do this at home. You should go buy the comics and you should stop on every panel and go, what is that referencing?
And I kind of think it's impressive he went through and added a glossary, because at this point we make so many references just in conversations with each other. I forget what it is I'm even referencing sometimes, because it's become such a normal part of my own lexicon. Like,
yeah, like what was the primary document on that?
Yeah, exactly. Like, do you have your TPS report? You know, like.
Yeah, but everybody knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just to the point where like, oh yeah, where did that come from exactly? Like, how did that interact with where did I get that? Like, the way I can drop a Big Lebowski reference in without even realizing I'm doing that.
At least three times in the course of doing this show, I have found out a reference, so I thought, and said what I thought it was referencing, only to discover that I actually found a secondary reference.
Yeah.
The Beryllium Sphere, which is the power source in Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest was actually making a reference. It's in The Shadow, the Alec Baldwin movie.
No. Oh.
So, and that's happened two or three times where I thought I found the reference, but the reference I found was actually referencing an older property that was actually Javier's reference.
Yeah.
Oh, there was something he brought up that I thought it was from Team Knight Rider, and it was, but it was also from, I think, Strangelove, where like the original reference was so much cooler than what I found. But what I found was also a reference, because, yeah, some of these things are so classic that it's hard to know, you know, am I referring to the main thing or am I referring to a joke made later?
Yeah.
It's made it a really fun rabbit hole to crawl through on the show. And also occasionally it's made me red face embarrassed when I watch Javier live tweet these things and immediately go, no, it's this. Like, shit. I'm a fool.
Damn it.
Well, thank you so much for Melissa for helping me talk about the comic.
Hey, no problem. Not at all.
And until next time, I guess this show's not too pretty to live, but the comic book's done. You should go read it. The Good Die Young is an independently run podcast produced by Les Weiler and hosted as part of the Permanent Record Network. We can be found on the web at thegooddieyoungtv.com. Les can be found doing weekly television commentary at www.thetvdudes.com. Thanks for listening.